you realize how polarized the world is, and you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Use concepts, use ideas like Love is Blind to put relationships through a bit more rigor. Is that person right? They're brilliant, but you know, they're missing this one attribute that I think that's important. And so you're always thinking, is there something else out there? The thing with dating apps for me is like, it's the human, it's the input that is ruining the experience, not the app. The app at its core should allow you to reach more people.
Mr. Tom Stroud.
Hi, guys.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I wanted to start this off by asking you, can you tell the listeners and viewers a bit about you and a bit about your story?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I guess the reason why I'm sat here today is because I've had, a bit of profile as a result of a Netflix dating show that I went on, which we shot the summer before last, a show called Love is Blind. And the concept of the show, for those viewers that haven't seen it, is it's all about whether or not you can find a connection, a romantic connection with someone sight unseen, as they call it. So go through an experience where you date 15 women quite heavily over a two-week period and see if you can get a connection which is strong enough to propose to that person without meeting them. And then the show then charts your journey from that point onwards, where you go on holiday with that person and then you live with them, and it sort of stress tests your relationship to see whether or not you're ready to say yes at the altar about 5 weeks later.
How was that show? Was that stressful, or was it actually a very enjoyable experience?
It's a bit of both. I mean, I loved filming it. It was amazing. It was such a unique experience.
It's a very cool show.
Yeah. And I mean, how many times can you say, you know, when you're on your deathbed, that I had an experience like that, right?
Yeah. So, awesome.
Wow. It was amazing. And I learned loads about myself, but the release of it was the part of it which became quite challenging, because it's TV at the end of the day, right? They have to focus on very polarizing storylines and points of view, because that's what brings the viewers in. So and I was caught up in a couple of storylines which at the time felt very stressful. They were big talking points, relevant to anyone that's in a romantic relationship at the moment or has been, you know. So things like gender dynamics in relationships, financial contribution, you know, how your values as a human being inform the kind of person that you want to date. And it's one of the big learnings about a show like that is man's trash is another man's treasure, you know. It was amazing seeing the reaction to it, and it wasn't always positive, particularly on social media.
How have you found it since then? You said lastly about it not being as positive as you would have thought on social media. Mm. Have you found it hard coming off the show and sort of sitting there and being like, you know, I find it hard from my point of view on social media types of things, because people will see a 30-second clip, or they'll read an article and then they'll judge you on it. But that's not necessarily you solely as a person.
Yeah.
Have you found that hard coming off the show with things like that?
Yes. There have been times when it's been difficult. I mean, I've always tried to live my life with integrity. And to your point, the challenge you have with a show like that is people are going to make certain judgments based off a very, very small snippet.
Yeah.
And when you live your life with integrity, or you try to, there are times when you're like, that's not me, that's not who I am. And your natural inclination is to want to try and correct those people, but you can't. I mean, it's an audience of 16 million people around the world, right? If I was to spend all my time going on social media saying that's not right, I wouldn't have any time left for eating, sleeping and working.
Else.
Yeah, exactly.
What made you want to do it in the first place, out of curiosity?
Good question. I'd been... It really a great opportunity to reflect on this stuff. I'd been sort of stuck in this, I call it like a hamster wheel, really. You guys know what it's like, London life, like incredibly busy, focusing on my career. I'd been in quite a long-term relationship up until I was about 32, and then wasn't really going into dating consciously with intent, you know? And I sort of found myself in these patterns of like dating someone for 2 or 3 months and then it not working out. And the way that I'd rationalize that would always be like, I'm just not meeting the right people. So, and what I've learned since is it's not actually the people that I was meeting. It was me. I was the problem, right? I've always sort of described myself or thought about myself as someone that was very ambitious and picky and knew exactly the person that I wanted to meet. It's only through therapy and all that kind of inward looking self-development stuff that I realized that was very, very avoidant and dismissive of people that, you know, in retrospect might have made amazing life partners. So, but to answer your question, it had come at a point in my life where I'd sort of had that element of, understanding who I was a little bit more and understanding what I was looking for in a romantic relationship. I'd been through quite a traumatic time with my parents, where both of them had gotten sick at the same time. And then I'd taken a bit of a step back from work. And then, as if, you know, I believe that sometimes these opportunities present themselves at the time, which is right. And I got a DM. My DMs were pretty dusty up to that point, and I got a DM from a casting producer saying, would you consider doing something like this? And the rest is history.
That's kind of similar to what Alex Bowen said with Love Island.
Yeah.
When we had him on, we were like, what actually made you want to go on at the first place? And he was like, there wasn't really anything. It just felt like the right thing to do at that time.
Yeah.
It came out of nowhere at a time where I kind of needed something to come out of nowhere.
Right.
And that kind of feels like the same type of thing with Love is Blind. I think it's a great show. Like, I actually do. There's some shows I watch where I'm like, I'm not too sure on this one. I think Love is Blind's a really smart idea.
Yeah.
I think the TV program as itself is like super engaging. From being on there, have you found that sort of Love is Blind has changed your perspectives on relationships since then? Or has it made it, you know, just made it more clear to you what you actually want?
No, massively. I mean, it's honestly, I think anyone who's struggling to understand themselves or, you know, what they want from a relationship or the kind of partner that they're looking for, use concepts, use ideas like Love is Blind to put relationships through a bit more rigor, because the concept of trying to find a connection with someone without seeing them means that you remove any sort of physicality from that equation, right? And hey, like aesthetics, physical appearance is so important, and you know, it's like, this is genetic stuff, right? You want to try and find a partner who, you know, ultimately you're going to have attractive children with. That's the kind of biology around
Absolutely,
it.
Yeah.
But when you are forced to just have conversations with people without having that to almost cloud your judgment, like, it really makes you evaluate what you're looking for in a partner. I don't think, being honest with you guys, when the show was shot, I had 100% clarity on that stuff. I figured it out as I was going along, right? But because I had this view that sort of intangible spark, you know, that, like, you know, the thing, the Disney movie thing.
Yeah.
I thought that was it. And like, you have that and then you build the rest around it, but that's not right. It's not right at all. It's about
foundations first.
Exactly, the building blocks, you know, your values and who you are and your goals and your ambitions in life. And you don't necessarily need all of that to align, but I think the non-negotiables, figure out your non-negotiables and build the rest around it is what I'd say.
I want to take you back to the point where you thought this would be the right thing for you to do. I know that the DM came in, but was there a moment in time where it might have been when your parents got ill, where you needed to take a step back from work and then reevaluate, and that's when the DM came around? I want to take you back to that. What was that like for you?
Yeah, so I mean, it was, my parents had just started recovering at this point, right. So I did have the mind, you know, I guess the space in my life to say yes to something like that. But it was so weird because I was previously doing PR agency life in London, 60-70 hour weeks, no time to even, you know, have a shit, let alone like consider a decision like that.
Yeah.
And then because of what had happened with my folks, I was forced to take a step back, go into freelancing consultancy work, and I'd been working that way for 3 or 4 months, and then the DM came in January last year. So yeah, it was nice to be able to have the space to really think it through. But initially when it came in, I wasn't sure. I needed a lot of convincing.
Mm. And what's life been like since?
Absolute roller coaster. But, you know, I'm someone that really embraces like change. I quite like it when life becomes a bit more challenging and you're not just, you don't have that set routine all the time. You know, I really, really enjoy that. And, you know, I touched on the heat, the social media stuff. That was fucking hard. But you know, always trying to see the best out of all of these experiences, and it certainly helped me with my resilience, my sense of self, my ability to pick through the opinions of others and really just focus on, you know, the worthwhile stuff, you know, the stuff that I can learn from. But like I say, guys, I mean, after that period, like, yeah, I wouldn't be sat here today being able to talk about this stuff were it not for the show. So I'm like really, really grateful for it, and there's some really interesting stuff happening. You know, I've done loads of podcasts and panels, and you know, I'm doing one this evening with a dating app, talking about giving a male perspective on dating and relationships. And it's all because of the platform the show's given me. And, you know, equally as important, the stuff I've been putting out on my social media. I'm not going for the Boohoo brand deals or any of that. I'm too fucking old for that stuff. But but it does give you a platform, and it's, you know, what a privilege.
That's awesome.
Massively. Mm. I want to talk about this panel.
Yeah.
Dating apps.
Yeah.
What's your sort of view on dating apps as a whole? We talked about Bumble before.
Yeah.
Joe's on Bumble at the moment.
Yes, he is.
Any ladies out there? So. What's your view on dating apps and talking at this panel? What's the type of conversations you're going to be raising?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's kind of two parts to it, really, because I think dating apps as a concept, like, they get a bit of a hard time sometimes. And I think there's this dating fatigue at the moment, in London in particular, but I think it's something which is actually shared by everyone, you know?
Yeah.
And the reason why there's fatigue is because of this kind of paradox or fallacy of choice, right? Like I always call it, where they're meant to have made it easier to date, but they've made it harder because you almost have too much choice if you're lucky enough, you know? But there's this great book that I was reading yesterday in the bath called How Not to Die Alone by Logan Urie. Right, have you read it?
No, I haven't read a book. Oh, but
good, I haven't read a book.
I'm trying. It's something I'm looking at at the moment.
Are you?
I'm trying to get into it more.
Yeah,
I take my information in through podcasts,
yeah,
and things like that.
Interesting.
So say if the book was in a podcast form, I'd listen to it.
But sounds this like is, a good idea though.
Yeah, audio book in a way. But for some reason, sorry, I'm going off a tangent.
No, not at all.
I struggle with audiobooks for some reason. When it's the exact wording on the page,
yeah,
not great, but when it's explained in a different sort of way,
interesting,
in a podcast style, in a conversation style like we're having, I get it.
Yeah.
And I don't know, maybe that's just me, maybe it's the way my brain works and my ADHD, but for sure, when I've listened to books and someone explain it in a different way,
yeah,
absolutely love it.
That's interesting.
Absolutely love it. But yeah,
great idea for a podcast, that, by the way.
It's a good idea for, like, a podcast.
Yeah, you know. But anyway, so this book, to round off the point, like, there's this concept in it. They identify these three dating tendencies, and one of them, the dating tendencies, is something called being a maximizer, which is like every single time you date someone, you're constantly thinking, is that person right? They're brilliant, but, you know, they're missing this one attribute that I think that's important. Mm. And so you're always thinking, is there something else out there, right? And what dating apps have facilitated is this ability to instantly access other people. And I think this is something which guys in particular can really identify with, particularly ambitious guys, because you're like, well, I have ambition in my life. You know, I have drive, I have goals. I know exactly what I want. Why shouldn't I take the same approach to dating? But there is this concept called satisfizers, right? This is another dating tendency, which is, and there's science behind this. When people make a decision, yeah, when they settle on a decision, your brain literally then rationalizes why that's a good decision. So these people are very, very happy once they've made a decision with somebody. They're like, I'm just going to invest in this person. I'm not going to worry about what else is out there or compare that person to someone else. And it's the same argument as if you go to an American restaurant and it's like, well, what do you want? The chili cheese, you know, the chili cheese fries, the double cheeseburger, the buttermilk chicken. I'm just going to pick the buttermilk chicken and be very, very happy with that decision. And sometimes that fallacy of choice, that whole idea that, like, oh my God, there's so much out there, can end up ruining the decision that you've made in the first place. And that's so interesting. So the thing with dating apps for me is, like, it's the human, it's the input that is ruining the experience, not the app. The app at its core should allow you to reach more people. And I think the same thing about social media in general. Like, it's humans that are fucking it up. It's not the platforms. Mm. So, and obviously there's a lot of nuance around that, but my general view is exactly that.
Apps like Bumble, we were talking about before. You said the girl messaged you, the woman messages you, yeah, first.
Yeah.
Do you see that as like a good icebreaker for things? Because I feel like we're, you know, could be a controversial thing to say, but I feel like a lot of men are expected to make that first, you know, initial engagement to the woman.
Yeah.
I quite like the idea of sort of just change it the other way around. And it's just, I think it's quite unique. I actually think it's a really cool idea. What's your view?
Wow. I mean, this goes into a whole separate topic around gender roles and the role.
Absolutely. I find it so interesting.
Yeah, I do.
So,
I mean, my view on gender roles, you know, we'd do a separate whole episode on that. But
let's do it.
Yeah, I think the idea that women have to message first, it gives or empowers women, right? And that's quite nice. There is obviously another conversation around safety on apps, and I think that leans into that as well. But the challenge is, I would imagine a lot of women, particularly women with maybe a more traditional mindset around gender dynamics might be like, oh, I don't want to message first. That's a guy's job. So, and that's kind of, you know, it's up to them to think that. It's not my decision whether or not that's the right attitude. But, and I think Bumble have now introduced a feature where women can choose whether or not they are the ones that message first. So it opens it up a little bit. But
that's interesting.
It's cool. I want to talk about more relationships because it's probably one of my favorite things to chat about. We've done so many good podcasts now talking about relationships. One question that we always ask is, are there any sort of characteristics which you think leads to a healthy relationship?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on this because I'm sad, absolutely, and lonely and single and I'm almost 40. But I think the main thing is, it's what I was chatting about earlier. It's about giving a bit more understanding that human beings are flawed and that the idea of a perfect human is Disney movie shit. And, you know, it's like there is beauty in someone's flaws. Like, that's the thing. It's what I always talk about, right? Like, it took me such a long time to understand my own flaws and my vulnerabilities. And the first part of that journey is like accepting the shit that you're bad at. The second part is being willing to communicate that to a romantic partner. And then the third part potentially is finding a partner that plugs the gaps in those flaws, you know, because you should never look for someone that's the mirror image of you. Like, it's this.
God forbid.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Can you imagine? Like 6'5", muscly athlete. So, so that's really important for me. It's like, you know, I want someone that compliments the stuff that I'm not very good at. And you know, I'm dating somebody at the moment who is amazing and is not the person that I ever imagined I'd date, and it's because of all the stuff that I've learned. And honestly, guys, I mean, we'll talk about family and background, and I'd love to hear your points of view on it, but like, I have these avoidant sort of signals when I'm in relationships, which is, oh my god, that she didn't say that thing quite right, oh my god, she, you know, whatever the flaw might be. And now I recognize those things and I rationalize them. I'm like, god, it's so ridiculous I'm even thinking that. Like, take a step back and just think about how much joy, love, happiness this person gives you. And that,
what's giving you that perspective? Age, experience, the show?
Yeah, all of the above and shitloads of therapy. I mean, it's you know, it's obviously depending on the type of therapy you do, like a lot of it is about looking at your childhood and those building blocks. And you know, that's been the most valuable stuff for me, is understanding myself and the my triggers, my automatic reaction to situations, and almost that being like me going on autopilot rather than really interrogating the reason why I feel that way.
So with therapy, if you don't mind me asking, what did that unravel for you, looking back on that, when you started to go to therapy? What did that bring up in you, whether it be ripping off the band-aid and finding those old wounds? What was that for you?
Oh god, I mean, I suppose the best way to answer that question is to start with what was the reason to go in the first place. And I went through my teens and my 20s with a total lack of self-awareness, and the way that manifested itself, I was just very selfish. Like, and the reason why I was selfish was because as a kid, I had to protect myself because I experienced a lot of rejection, a lot of abandonment by the people that were supposed to be my caregivers, right? So you can understand then how that would make you close up into yourself and just care about your own well-being. But I started becoming aware of those traits. I really struggled to build healthy relationships, not just romantically, but with my friends and with my family. Yeah. I'd end up alienating people. And once I became aware of it, I mean, to my point earlier, like, that's your first step. But then you're like, oh, I don't know why I'm like this. And I would struggle. And I remember having situations where my friends within my friendship group, I was always a pretty outgoing guy, so I didn't struggle to make friends, but there was no depth to those relationships. And I'd see these little like pairings where you could really see that they were like supporting each other emotionally, like showing vulnerability. And I'd be like, why does no one want to open up to me like that? And it's because I wasn't able to show them or mirror that kind of behavior. You know, it's like, it's one of the really interesting things about sort of the human condition, is like, it feels so good to help other people. And that is almost like now has become a real, my purpose and my driving force, right? But when I was that age, I was desperate to do it, but I couldn't understand why people wouldn't let me help them. It's because I wouldn't let them help me. So can't remember your question anymore. I just went off on a little rant.
The triggers that came up when it is a result of therapy, which everything you said thus far, I can really, really relate to.
Right.
You see me nodding along, being like, yes, it's so relatable.
Okay.
So,
we've both done therapy.
Big time. Very big time. It was more when you went into therapy, what came up for you that allowed you to then go on that healing journey to then move forward with the rest of your life?
So, yeah. So the first moment where I was like, I need to seek help is because I was just muddling through and I had this awareness and met someone amazing in my sort of mid to late 20s, a very, very secure woman. And the minute I met her, I don't know, I mean, this kind of plays into this Disney stuff, but the minute I met her, I was like, that girl is going to be my girlfriend. Like, I just knew it straight away. And it was like a feeling that I'd never had before. And as I got to know her, like, I was just like, yeah, she represents everything that I've always wanted. Mm. And not just that sort of like family, that sort of creating that unit together, but also to my own point, like her attributes, her qualities, her traits, I didn't have. Mm. She was so, so secure, so sure of who she was. She didn't need to shout it from the rooftop. She wasn't outgoing like I am, but I think a lot of that now in retrospect probably comes from my own insecurity, right? She just represented this love. And we were in a relationship for 4 or 5 years. And she was incredibly loyal. I trusted her in a way that I'd never trusted anyone in my life before. And so that helped. But long and short, I freaked out. There was a point where it was like, right, we need to get married and have babies now. And I just didn't have the faith or the, you know, the ability to lean into that because I knew that that would involve me showing every single part of myself to that person. And that scared me. And we ended up breaking up and I used the excuse that I wasn't ready, but or maybe I wasn't ready. But after that point, I went traveling for a year, did the classic, like sold my flat, quit my job, got rid of all my possessions, traveled around Asia. Didn't find myself, just found that I like drinking buckets on a beach in Thailand. Yeah.
That's always good.
Yeah, exactly, always. Exactly. Meeting gap year students. But like, when I got back, I felt the lowest I'd ever felt because I hadn't processed that breakup. And that was the point where I was like, I need to start looking at this stuff. And so that was the reason I went into therapy. But
I'm finding everything you're saying just like almost quite relatable in a way. In terms of that, the thing you said before about shallow, almost having shallow friends.
Yeah.
And never fully understanding why. Not that you're not clicking with people the same.
Yeah.
But I feel like as humans, we're quick to push the problem onto someone else and not look at it introspectively.
Yeah.
And that's one of my biggest weaknesses is, you know, I could say something completely not meaning it in a rude way. But that person take it in a rude way and distancing themselves from me and then me being like, why is so-and-so being weird? Like, I don't understand.
Yeah.
I'm starting to figure out that a lot more because I had a lot of shallow, I call them shallow friends.
Yeah.
I had a lot of shallow friends growing up where I wouldn't have a proper connection. I'd always be quite liked at school, but I never had, I maybe have like one or two, even to this day, one or two, three, like really close friends who like I really trust. And that's always been a massive problem for me. And I found it so interesting when you said that because I feel like that's where we were very similar in that aspect. But looking introspectively now,
yeah,
as you said as well, that with like part of my French scares the shit out of me.
Yeah,
I'm not gonna lie.
Yeah.
Because I think that comes from insecurity too, insecurity in myself. But I'm starting to get more comfortable with that because I'm finding my girlfriend is very secure too. And we talked about this on the last episode. I'm like that a lot of the time, if I'm being honest. She's very constant and it brings my waves down. And that's something I found that massively helps. But sort of that looking internally, realizing that actually I'm not I'm the problem 100% of the time, but a lot of it stems from my own problems and then sort of putting a glaze up and being like, oh, yeah, it's their fault. It's not my fault. And then trying to move on.
Yeah.
I find that really powerful recently. And it's actually made a big difference to my life and my friendships and stuff as well. Like just with Joe and I, for example, like we're pretty open with each other. We're pretty transparent. And if there's someone's blame or if there is a blame, I think we both now take initiative of that, which at the start, I don't know if we did.
No.
But that's made a massive difference, especially in friendships. I've noticed it. Massively, and I that's something. If anyone's listening, I couldn't recommend more. And I just wanted to raise the point because I haven't spoke about that sort of things, and I felt like when you mentioned it, I was like, completely get that.
Nice. That's honestly, like, it's one of the things that therapy teaches you. It's what was the analogy I always use with therapy is like it's like a roller coaster, and that seems like an obvious analogy, but what I mean by that is you have a dip first. I found it really challenging for the first 6 months. I felt like I was getting worse. But that's because you have to confront all of these like learned behaviors and your own flaws, and eventually what it teaches you is that, like, you know, it's okay that you have those sort of challenges. But even when it comes to, you know, platonic friendships, admitting your own flaws is incredible. And then, you know, once you start putting in the work, like, to understand them and try and maybe rectify them, like, having the honesty to do that is such an empowering feeling. And what I found is that I would normally shut off when people would confront me, whether or not it was about a character trait, whether or not it was like in the workplace where I'd done a shit bit of work. And as I went through the years of therapy, I found it so much easier to take that feedback on board. And like, if you're able to be like, you know what, I recognize that, absolutely, I'm going to work on that, like, that shows a commitment to your own growth. And what else can you be like, what else can you do as a human being, like, that is better than just being committed to growing as a person? Like, it's the number one trait that I look for in a partner. And also their ability to help me grow and call out my bullshit.
I think telling the truth is a big one.
Oh my God.
Mark Twain said, if you tell the truth, you have nothing to remember.
Yeah.
And like, I completely agree with that, because that weighs quite heavily on you trying to remember your lies all the time. And just the minute you tell the truth and you're open with someone, the amount of, what's the word? Not the amount of relaxation you get, but the amount of relief you get is massive. That's my number one thing I looked for in a partner. Someone who's truthful and honest and is like open with me. And then the minute that happens, that's when I feel like I could open up and really be myself. And that's when I had that level of trust, because I struggled to trust people. It takes a long time with me. So that truthfulness, that for me, that's the number one thing I'm looking for in particular.
I mean, it doesn't even need to be as black and white as dishonesty, right? Like, this also like bleeds into this idea of like ego and the version of yourself that you present to external parties. And because I know a lot of people, particularly in the industry I work in, who are these incredibly polished people, very aspirational, but what you realize is that their authentic self isn't that at all. And that's why people get burnt out. That's why people need to go to therapy, because they're presenting this version of themselves which isn't real. And eventually it's tiring. To your earlier quote,
absolutely,
you know, like, you have to remember what
all
version exactly what version you're presenting. And it's one thing that is amazing realization post show, you know, is that, god man, like, being a guy and not living up to that typical stereotype of a guy is so freeing. Like, I've loved it. It was a big part of my storyline, was that I'm not a traditional masculine figure. And it felt quite alienating at first, because it was everything that I'd been taught that I shouldn't be. But now I love it. You know, it feels really nice.
I wanted to touch on your childhood as well. You talked about your dad before. You talked about your uncle. Can you explain to people a bit more about the story there, as I know it's going to help a lot of people listening?
So this is it's one of the reasons why it's such a privilege to do this, guys. Like, I know that you've got a lot of male listeners, but women as well. Like, it's I mean, you look at the data, like, the majority of childhoods now are in broken homes. Like, it's over 50% now, the parental divorce. Over 50% of children have experienced that. So I had a tough childhood, because I had a dad, this which I idolized, who had a very, him and my mum broke up when I was four, and I had a very sporadic relationship with him, where once or twice a year I'd see him, but because of that I sort of built him up into this amazing figure, right? And every time I'd see him, he'd bring me a nice gift, and I thought that was what parenthood was at that age. So but yeah, I'd see him very, very rarely, and because of that, like, it really triggered a lot in me, and I felt a lot of abandonment, had a lot of anger. That's the emotion that sort of tended to manifest a lot more, and sadness. And I was always very academic as a kid, and I switched on kid, but I couldn't make sense of my emotions at all, and particularly that feeling that there was a big part of me that was missing. And I ended up going to live with him when I was 10, because it got so bad, like my anger issues, that social services basically stepped in and had this meeting with my mum, who's an amazing, amazing woman, and then my dad and his partner at the time, where this therapist, I remember this, it's a sort of core memory which came back to me quite recently. Everyone was arguing about what they were going to do with me, and The therapist there was like, everyone shut up, and just turned to me and was like, Tom, what do you want? And I said, I just want to live with my dad, which would have been, you know, heartbreaking for my mum at the time. I ended up going to live with my dad. Long and short, he didn't have the kind of minerals to look after a kid, right? Because he's a haunted man himself. And I lived with him for a year in London, and then my mum took me away on a family holiday, and we're on the way back from the holiday. She was trying to get in touch with him. She couldn't get in touch with him. So I drove to his house to drop me off on the way back to Brighton, where she was living. And it basically just disappeared, just done a runner and just bottled it. And so that, as a sort of 10, 11-year-old boy, if you think about that as a kind of core memory, I remember when I first started doing therapy, and one of these memories, these dreams that I'd always have, with this like big blue door, and knocking on this door, and it wouldn't open no matter how hard I tried, it wouldn't open. And that was the memory that I had from back in those days. It was a metaphor, you know. So my mum ended up having to take me back home, sort out of school within a few days' notice. And the only time I saw my dad after that was when I was 14. That was the last time I saw him. So that sort of played a lot into that feeling of abandonment. And then the sort of second event, which really shaped who I am as a human being, was my uncle, my mum's brother, who was this incredible charismatic man, but incredibly up and down. And you see that a lot of people with charisma, like it's hard for them to carry that weight, that expectation they've set themselves. But he suffered with very severe depression, and this was something which my mum kind of tried to keep me at arm's length from during my childhood, but I'd see these little signals and little signs as I was growing up. There were times when he'd have to get sectioned, basically go into these sort of mental health institutes, and then he'd come out again. And but he committed suicide when I was 17. So he jumped in front of a bus, and so there were two moments for me which really sort of established that people that are meant to be your caregivers can't be trusted, and also really skewed my views of men, and probably, you know, where I am today is a lot better. But up until a couple of years ago, I really struggled to trust men, particularly older men that were meant to take care of you, right? And that honestly bled into every part of my life, whether it was meeting my girlfriend's dad, whether it was having a boss at work. You know, it was crazy. Even just having friendships with guys that I was supposed to trust. Like, I wouldn't be able to have an open dialogue with this, like this, because I didn't trust guys. I was worried that I'd give them something that you know, they'd use it in the wrong way. And so, yeah, amazing unpicking all of that stuff. And I've, you know, I'm very lucky that I can talk about it openly now, but at times I just couldn't figure it out. And, you know, the message for your listeners is like, well, that kind of abandonment will happen to anyone to a degree in your life. And, you know, understanding it is the most important thing you can do, because it will genuinely help you with your life and with your relationships with people.
It's honestly like everything you're saying there is just like, it's so poignant for me and many listeners and viewers that get in touch with us say some things along those lines, and friends of mine that say the same thing. It's just, it's so refreshing to hear someone that's literally like mirroring things that I've been through, and many people that get in touch with us say exactly the same thing. Yeah. Thank you for sharing that.
No,
it's amazing.
You're welcome. So you've kind of had similar...
Yeah. So parents broke up, I'm 11 or 12, slightly older than when you were. And the father figure that came into my life, my dad wasn't the sort of the father that I would have anticipated. I mean, didn't disappear as such, but wasn't there at all. Never there in any capacity that I'd ever want him to. And then the father figure that came in to my mum remarried to was just, yeah, very abusive, and right. Yeah, alcohol, drugs, all this kind of stuff was a very point in our life up until the age of maybe 18, 19, and then it really, really sort of kicked off, which kickstarted my mental health journey as well, which led us to here now. So I'm like you, extremely lucky that's happened to me, so I can give that back to people like us who have gone through or going through the same thing. You know, people listen to this and watch this now might be going through the same thing, thinking, yeah, shit, my stepdad, father, uncle, whatever, is abusive and what can I do about it? It's just us giving our journeys and experiences, and we're out the other side.
Yeah.
Not perfect by any stretch. No. You know, I say that often, is we're not the finished article. You know, we're not people who have gone through therapy. We're coming out the other end and we're like, we've seen the light. You know, we still have our good days and bad days, and we're here to talk about our experiences. Mm. And by sharing it, my view was, it's a problem shared is a problem halved sometimes.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's what we're trying to install in other people, particularly in young men who, due to societal pressures, don't talk about their thing.
Mm.
And we're trying to make it okay not to be okay, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And there's a couple of things that I think, well, I'd hope would be quite useful to people, particularly people that have suffered similar experiences. Like my view around raising a family and having children when I was in my 20s and my early 30s was, I don't want that. And I thought that's because I was like smashing it in my career. But it wasn't. That was just a mask. It was because I didn't want to make the same mistakes my father had, because I intrinsically knew in my subconscious the impact that it had on me. Mm. So it was another huge factor in my inability to form healthy romantic relationships with people, because I knew that eventually they'd come to a point where I'd need to step up into that. And oh my God, like the last couple of years of therapy, when you're doing the inner child work and you start thinking about yourself as a child. And I remember when that concept was first introduced, and every single time I thought about myself as a kid, I'd just burst into tears. Like, it's making me feel quite emotional now just talking about it. But I kind of moved from a point where my emotions were very reactive into being able to take a bit of a step back and thinking about, how can I care for that child, and what would I have done, you know? And that is an amazing thing, because eventually it makes you realize, maybe I would be a good father, and you know, maybe I do have the minerals to step into that role and not make the same mistakes my father did.
So I mean, you're literally exactly what I said, when, because I wasn't originally going to be a host on this show, right?
Yeah.
I came on as a guest. So episode number one of Tom's podcast on his own, I came on and he asked me about that. And I said, about being a father one day. And I said, I would love to be all the things that my father figures weren't to me. So I've actually learned the hard way.
Mm-hmm.
And they've taught me all the things I don't want to be. And it's actually, honestly, it's exactly what I said. Remember when I first said that to you on the first episode? So it's just amazing. And my question to you would be, what's your view on potentially being a father down the road as of now, since you've gone through those things? Hard question to answer, obviously, because obviously you're early on in stages of dating and stuff. Has it changed for you?
100%. Like, it's something that I want, like, in my core being. And you know, when I see my friends with kids and stuff, like, I feel so much like care and compassion over their children. And I just can't think of a better purpose in your life than bringing up a child and showing them what love and care looks like. And and also, just, I mean, there's this idea of like generational trauma, right? And I've done a lot of reading around that. And when I think about my father's family and his dad and his mum, and it's passed down from generation to generation, this stuff, and often it gets more pronounced and worse and worse and worse. So it's up to somebody eventually to stop that. And that responsibility is something that I would relish. You know, it really excites me, that idea. And interestingly, I mean, she won't mind me talking about this, but the person that I'm dating at the moment is, you know, we've only been dating for a couple of months. She's like, I want a family. Like, that's what she wants. She's like, I have so much love that I want to give to other people. She talks about love so freely and so simply. Mm. That would have freaked the shit out of me a couple of years ago. Honestly, it would have scared me off. And now I'm like, yeah, like, people put up, particularly kids that have gone through trauma, put up all these barriers to love. And, you know, I'm like, my subconscious, it's moving too quickly. It's only been a couple of months. And she's sort of saying, you know, we're boyfriend and girlfriend. And I'm like, well, we're not boyfriend and girlfriend. And I'm like,
we're seeing each other.
Yeah, exactly. Stupid labels, you know? And it's made me really question, like, that stuff's all bollocks. Like, if you know that it's right and you're moving in the right direction, like, why put up these barriers? It's so ridiculous. I'm going to be talking on this panel later about the exact thing. It's a British stiff upper lip mentality where it's like, we have to go through these stages, and it's just stupid. And the more men that can become more open to, I don't know, having a more fluid view of this stuff, but more importantly, accepting the love of others without it, with their own bias or insecurity coming into it, like, the more healthy relationships we're going to have. I'm sure of it.
Do you find, I was just talking about this now. I was trying to think back to before when you were sharing your stuff. Do you find this kind of therapeutic in a way? Talking on a podcast, talking about, because Joe and I say this all the time when you talk about things. When we got off that first podcast, we were both just quiet, weren't we? We were like, feels like I'm back in therapy. But I don't know, because I feel in a great place at the moment, but we film this so consistently that the more I think about it, the more I feel like this is almost, I know we're not professionals, but therapy in a way, sort of helping other people and sharing our stories with other people, I feel incredibly grateful for. But also selfishly, I think Joe feels the same. This is kind of a release for us too. How do you feel about it?
It's a really great question. And I think therapy has a stigma around it. And
it does, 100%.
For obvious reasons, right? Because of the way it's presented visually through the kind of channels that men in particular might see it, where it's like, oh God, like, I mean, a really good reference point is like Good Will Hunting. And have you ever seen that movie?
Great film.
Yeah, incredible. Great film. Normalizing therapy. But yeah. I remember when I was a kid seeing that movie and thinking, I want a Robin Williams. I need a Robin Williams in my life. So,
which is the irony of Robin Williams. And what,
God.
Yeah.
Gosh. So, but I think for the most part, the way that it's presented visually and the language that's used around it can be quite alienating to a lot of guys. So,
it's true.
I think that's less a question about does it feel like therapy to you, and more just saying it is therapy. Like it's the same as having a chat with your mates down the pub might be. But the advantage of therapy and talking to someone that's trained in that stuff is that they can make sure that they're safeguarding and making sure that
absolutely,
they're
yeah.
you know, controlling the direction of the conversation, and also forcing people to reflect and do their own work with it. And that's the difference with a chat with one of the boys down the pub, is that the lads, it's not their fault at all. They have their own bias and their own point of view. One of the interesting things I've thought about when you're chatting to your friends is like, as a friend, their responsibility is to protect you. So, which is amazing, but sometimes that can mean that they're not giving you proper impartial advice. Mm-hmm. So if it's about a girl that you're dating and she's treating you like shit, like they might just, their agenda is about supporting you and protecting you rather than actually digging into the behavior of the woman or digging into the behavior of the pal, you know? So, and that's the amazing thing about therapy, is it's really impartial. And sometimes the stuff you're confronted with feels fucking harsh and not the kind of stuff which a mate would ever confront you. So.
I wanted to go onto the point of your uncle as well. We talked about this before. Can you just tell people a bit more about that?
Yeah. So, I mean, he was somebody that was kind of just haunted, I guess is the right way to describe it. And he had this beautiful life. Like he was the guy, you know, there's a guy in every family that you sort of talk about, he's like mythological creature where like he went to art college, studied, became a makeup artist, would do work for Playboy magazine and get flown out to these shoots where he would be doing the makeup for like these international glamour models. The woman he was with was David Bowie's muse. Like he had all these amazing stories from around the world, and I just thought he was the best thing since sliced bread. But he was a really troubled man, and his suicide didn't come as a shock to my mum, but it was to me to an extent, because she tried to protect me from it. And I remember certain moments in our journey together where I remember being at my grandma's house, and I was like 14, 15 maybe, and sat around the table with all the family, and then people would slowly start going to bed, and it was just me and him, and he was drunk, he was an alcoholic, and he'd had a few drinks, and he just sort of looked at me and he said, sometimes I just don't want to be here anymore. And that was the moment where I sort of thought, you know, he has this amazing life on paper, but the reality of it is he's, you know, he finds life really
deeply
difficult.
Troubled.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it was hard. It was hard when he committed suicide. It was the day before my S levels. And, you know, going through an experience like that is really tough, especially as a 17-year-old. But there was an element of coming to peace with it, because he wasn't happy. And I know this sounds like a weird thing to say, but he wasn't someone I could ever imagine as an old man. Like, you know, and the vision I have of him now is the energetic, charismatic Chris, rather than probably the old, lonely Chris, which he would have become, because you know, he wasn't mentally in a position where, you know, he could do the normal things which normal people do.
It's a very sad story. I just hate to bring it back to other points of views of other people's stories, because it's not our point to share. But Fraser, who we had on the podcast 2 weeks ago talking about Everything Movember, lost his dad 2 weeks before his AS levels.
GCSE.
And he was sort of talking about the mask he had to put on. Mm. Did you find you had the same thing when it was with your uncle? Just sort of that, I'm okay. Mm. Like almost that disassociating yourself from your body in a way is something he spoke about quite heavily, because his mum was struggling so heavily. He was trying to just, you know, he was like, I don't know what to do here. And he felt like he was out of body a lot of the time. Mm. I haven't personally gone through losing my mum or dad, so I can't relate at all. Is that something that was similar to you as well? Just sort of not feeling part of your body, or not feeling like you have to block it out in a way?
Honest answer, I don't remember a single point where I was like, I need to be strong here. It didn't affect me. There was a subconscious thing in my brain which was like, just got to move on with it. And I think that was because of my conditioning as a kid and just having to battle through this stuff. And so I suppose people talk about resilience, and sometimes that could be quite a positive thing, but it wasn't until years later, decades later, where I started to figure out the impact that it had on me.
It all built up.
Yeah, exactly. So interesting, this stuff. My biological dad, my absent father, who I hadn't since I was 14, he passed away this summer just gone. And because of everything I've learned, like, my automatic reaction wasn't one of sadness. Like, I went to his funeral, 5 people at his funeral, which just kind of shows you the way he'd chosen to live his life. But I had no reaction to it at all. Like, I felt very sad on the day, but I was expecting this wave of emotion and sadness to hit me, and it didn't. And like, I found it really interesting trying to reflect on that stuff. And the place that I've come to with it is, it almost feels like that's the end of that chapter, and that everything that I've been haunted with about him and this carrot that's been dangled of maybe having a relationship with him throughout my adult life, like, that's gone now. And there's something really freeing about that. It feels quite nice. And it makes me sound like an arsehole saying it, but I feel like that's a big part of the reason with this journey I'm on now, where my life's just suddenly gone like that. And so I would never, ever want to try and take a positive out of someone else's death. But that's been my experience. Mm.
I was going to ask you about that. The sort of almost cathartic nature of that is, it almost like a one chapter closes, another one opens. Mm. I mean, like you said, you won't want to use someone's death as a reason to move on from something, but it almost is.
Yeah.
A bit like, I mean, it's an awful thing to say it, but with your uncle, I think he was so unwell for such a long time that with suicide, it's a funny one. When someone either tries to a number of times or they really don't want to be here, it's almost a relief when it happens, because you can then start to grieve rather than almost waiting for it to happen.
Oh, God.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely does. Yeah. And that is a horrible,
powerful.
Yeah, a horrible feeling as a child or as an adult. Like, I can't imagine what it would have been like for my mum knowing that moment was going to happen. She found him, she found him in the bath with his wrist slashed. Like, there was, so you're absolutely right. Imagine that, where you cherish the relationship you have with someone so much, but you know there's a finality to it, and it's going to happen pretty quickly. Yeah. So you're right. There was, I think perhaps that explains a lot of the reason why we all felt incredibly emotional and at his funeral stuff, but then we all moved on from it because we were like, well, he's at peace now, and perhaps now we can move on with our lives.
Yeah.
I'd like to end on this question, because it's been one of my favourite conversations we've had, is if you could give one piece of advice to young men out there who may be struggling with their mental health at the moment, what piece of advice would that be?
Oh, God. It's a big one, that one, isn't it? Yeah, it's a lot of responsibility.
It's always my favourite.
No pressure.
The world is hard at the moment. Like, the world is polarised and fractured, and I think the US election result shows that men are struggling. They need role models. They need someone to learn from. And, you know, sadly, like, without me letting my political views get in the way of this too much, like, the person who's now been elected as the US president is someone that represents strength and maybe, an element of, like, this sort of headstrong, I'm going to run my own race, I don't care what people think nature. And I think a lot of guys, young guys in particular, buy into that. But like, men are struggling with traditional gender roles, and the stuff that their fathers taught them or the fathers taught them no longer applies. Equality, you know, whether that's female representation in leadership, whether that's the gender pay gap, all that stuff is getting better, and that's so positive. But I think for a lot of men, they struggle to understand their role anymore. And to bring it back to my narrative on the show, right, like, I got a lot of stick for not being a provider, not having this provider mentality, particularly for women that are more traditional. And the one piece of I would give to men, the one piece of advice I would give to young men is figure out what that provider mindset means for yourself. How can you provide for yourself and give yourself care, love, the resources that you need to really grow and develop? And if that's about finding a role model, so be it. But if you don't have any role models in your life, it's about doing the work for yourself and taking that responsibility on.
Amazing. Awesome.